the preferring and choosing of already created psychic material in the dream thoughts. Now there is a case where it is spared the work, for the most part, of building, as it were, a facade to the dream, by the fact that such a structure, waiting to be used, is already to be found complete in the material of the dream thoughts. The element of the dream thoughts which I have in mind, I am in the habit of designating as a fantasy. Perhaps I shall avoid misunderstanding if I immediately adduce the daydream of waking life as an analogy. The part played by this element in our psychic life has not yet been fully recognized and investigated by the psychiatrists. In this study, M. Benedict has, it seems to me, made a highly promising beginning. The significance of the daydream has not yet escaped the unerring insight of poets. The description of the daydreams of one of his subordinate characters, which A. Daudet gives us in Nabab, is universally known. A study of the psychoneuroses discloses the astonishing fact that these fantasies, or daydreams, are the immediate predecessors of hysterical symptoms, at least of a great many of them. Hysterical symptoms directly depend not upon the memories themselves, but upon fantasies built on the basis of memories. The frequent occurrence of conscious day fantasies brings these formations within the scope of our knowledge. But just as there are such conscious fantasies, so there are a great many unconscious ones which must remain unconscious on account of their content and on account of their origin from repressed material. A more thorough examination into the character of these day fantasies shows with what good reason the same name has been given to these formations as to the products of our nocturnal thought, dreams. They possess an essential part of their properties in common with nocturnal dreams. An examination of them would really have afforded the shortest and best approach to an understanding of night dreams. Like dreams, they are fulfillments of wishes. Like dreams, a good part of them are based upon the impressions of childish experiences. Like dreams, their creations enjoy a certain amount of indulgence from the censor. If we trace their formation, we see how the wish motive, which is active in their production, has taken the material of which they are built, mixed it together, rearranged it, and composed it into a new unit. They bear the same relation to the childish memories, to which they go back, as some of the quaint palaces of Rome bear to the ancient ruins, whose free stones and pillars have furnished the material for the structure built in modern form. In the secondary elaboration of the dream content, which we have ascribed to our fourth dream-making factor, we again find the same activity which in the creation of daydreams is allowed to manifest itself unhampered by other influences. We may say without further preliminary that this fourth factor of ours seeks to form something like a daydream from the material at hand. Where, however, such a daydream has already been formed in connection with the dream thought, this factor of the dream work will preferably get control of it, and strive to introduce it into the dream content. There are dreams which consist merely of the repetition of such a day fancy, a fancy which has perhaps remained unconscious, as, for instance, the dream of the boy that he is riding with the heroes of the Trojan War in a war chariot. In my dream, Autodidaska, at least the second part of the dream is the faithful repetition of a day fantasy, harmless in itself, about my dealings with Professor N. The fact that the fantasy thus provided more often forms only one part of the dream, or that only one part of the fantasy that makes its way to the dream content, has its origin in the complexity of the conditions which the dream must satisfy at its genesis. On the whole, the fantasy is treated like any other component of the latent material. Still, it is often recognizable in the dream as a whole. In my dreams, parts often occur which are emphasized by an impression different from that of the rest. They seem to me to be in a state of flux, to be more coherent, and at the same time more transient than other pieces of the same dream. I know that these are unconscious fantasies, which get into the dream by virtue of their association, but I have never succeeded in registering such a fantasy. For the rest, these fantasies, like all other component parts of the dream thoughts, are jumbled together and condensed, one covered up by another, and the like. But there are all degrees from the case where they may constitute the dream content, or at least the dream facade, unchanged, to the opposite case, where they are represented in the dream content by only one of their elements, or by a remote allusion to such an element. The extent to which the fantasies are able to withstand the demands of the censor and the tendency to condensation are, of course, also decisive of their fate among the dream thoughts. In my choice of examples for dream analysis, I have, wherever possible, avoided those dreams in which unconscious fancies play a somewhat important part, because the introduction of this psychic element would have necessitated extensive discussion of the psychology of unconscious thought. But I cannot entirely omit the fantasy even in this matter of examples, because it often gets fully into the dream and still more often distinctly pervades it. I may mention one more dream, which seems to be composed of two distinct and opposed fantasies, overlapping each other at certain places, of which the first is superficial, while the second becomes, as it were, the interpreter of the first. The dream, it is the only one for which I have no careful notes, is about to this effect. The dreamer, an unmarried young man, is sitting in an inn, which is seen correctly. Several persons come to get him, among them someone who wants to arrest him. He says to his table companions, "I will pay later, I am coming back." But they call to him, laughing scornfully, "We know all about that, that's what everybody says." One guest calls after him, "There goes another one." He is then led to a narrow hall, where he finds a woman with a child in her arms. One of his escorts says, "That is Mr. Muller." A commissioner or some other official is running through a bundle of tickets or papers, repeating, "Muller, Muller, Muller." At last the commissioner asks him a question, which he answers with, "Yes." He then takes a look at the woman and notices that she has grown a large beard. The two component parts are here easily separated. What is superficial is the fantasy of being arrested. It seems to be newly created by the dream work. But behind it appears the fantasy of marriage, and this material, on the contrary, has undergone but slight change at the hands of the dream activity. The features which are common to both fantasies come into distinct prominence as in a Galton's composite photograph. The promise of the bachelor to come back to his place at the club table, the scepticism of the drinking companions, sophisticated in their many experiences, the calling after, "There goes, marries, another one," all these features can easily be capable of the other interpretation. Likewise the affirmative answer given to the official, running through the bundle of papers with a repetition of the name, corresponds to a subordinate but well-recognized feature of the marriage ceremonies. The reading aloud of the congratulatory telegrams which have arrived irregularly, and which, of course, are all addressed to the same name. In the matter of